All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is another Q&A where I will be answering your Falcons and off-season questions.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman. I've been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com, on Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today is another Q&A episode wrapping up the week here on Friday, February 22nd. And, you know, I appreciate everybody for sending in their questions, submitting them on Facebook and Twitter and email and whatnot. You can also submit them as a comment on FalcFans.com. And, you know, so many great questions that I know I'm not going to be able to get through them all. And thus, we're going to do what we did the last time, where we had some leftover questions, which is we're going to do a leftover mailbag that will be posted up on FalcFans.com probably this weekend, probably Saturday. Should be the day that I get it up, Saturday or Sunday. So definitely check that out to get to all the questions that you guys sent in this week that I didn't get to. And because I can write about them, I can be a little bit more long-winded than I normally try to be on this podcast, because I'm trying to get as many things done under 30 minutes as humanly possible. Although if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know I'm very long-winded and constantly going on tangents and whatnot, like I'm doing right now. But so look forward to that. The other sort of business, content-related business that I want to get before we get into this Q&A and start answering questions is that I do also plan on putting up a 7-round mock draft where I sort of project the Falcons, you know, picks in every round. And I thought earlier this week I would be able to put that up on Friday, but in all reality, it'll probably go up on the weekend. There also should be an updated mock draft database article on FalcFans.com. So a lot of content coming your way. Also will be content coming your way next week as I get back into the groove of producing content where I took a very long break off over the last year and a half over at FalcFans.com in terms of not producing content. So just taking a little bit of time for me to get back into that groove. So definitely want to check that out. But without further ado, let's get into today's Q&A questions. JB74 at Joe Bear 74 on Twitter asks, who is your top five wish list for each of the Atlanta's first two picks? Joe, I don't really have one because I tend to wait till after the combine and free agency before I start really doing a deeper dive into the draft. I've watched several players, but I think combine and free agency sort of streamlines things due to the fact that certain players won't test particularly well, and that will sort of move them off the Falcons' radar in the early rounds, as well as the fact that the Falcons will be able to fulfill some of their needs in free agency and therefore make it less likely that the Falcons will address those positions in the first two rounds. So I don't really have an answer for you, but particularly as far as second round picks go. But in terms of like first round picks, the guys that I've sort of glommed onto as the guys that I am so far, and again, I reserve the right to change my mind as I watch more and more of these guys moving forward. But so far, the guys that seem like they're realistic options for the Falcons at pick 14 that I like are Ed Oliver, the defensive tackle from Houston, Jonah Williams, the offensive tackle from Alabama, and Jawan Taylor, the offensive tackle from Florida. Mark Saber at Mark's Remark asks, Falcons defense needs a sack to win a Super Bowl, and you can have anyone in team history be on your front four. Who do you take? My picks are Patrick Kearney, John Abraham, Grady Jarrett, and Rod Coleman. And I will basically say that the reason why I picked those guys is because I'm a little bit biased towards there's three eras of my fandom. The most recent one being the 2005 to the present day, which is I would call the modern / DirecTV era, because I've been able to successfully, thanks in large part due to Sunday Ticket and, you know, internet connections, been able to watch pretty much every game the Falcons have played since the start of the 05 season. Prior to that, I would say from like 1997 to 2004, when I had internet access, and for part of that time I was in college, I was able to occasionally watch some of the Falcons games, but most of my following the team was done through, you know, spending days and hours upon hours scouring message boards and going online and whatnot. And prior to that, from like 1991 to 1996, like I was a little kid, didn't really have internet. And so basically, and rarely watched Falcon games during that time. I was just mainly a Falcon fan in name only, and with a couple of hats and whatnot and memorabilia. Basically, my following the team was through like magazines and newspapers and whatnot. So for me, at least, any player that played extensively prior to 2005, I can't necessarily. So that's a reason why I can't put Chuck Smith over Patrick Kearney. There are other reasons, but I just wanted to explain that. I just thought that was interesting. Didn't necessarily matter to my answer, but I guess. Joe B's next question is, would you prefer the Falcons trade away their one or two extra picks, or would you rather they keep those picks and draft players? I think a lot of it depends on what happens in free agency. I think normally I'm a believer when it comes to the draft that the more bats you have, a.k.a. the more picks you have, the more chances of success you have, because the draft is a crapshoot. But I also think if the Falcons are able to successfully fill some of their holes in free agency, they could get away with potentially trading some of their picks. Right now, they're projected to have 8 picks, possibly 9, depending on some conflicting information from over the cap. I think you can look at this Falcons roster currently and say there's probably, depending on how you feel about various spots, but there's probably about 12 to 15 spots that the Falcons could realistically address this offseason and upgrade or fill roster spots. And let's say there's 13 of those spots. And if you're able to successfully fill some of those holes in free agency, like say 6 of them, that means you really only need 7 draft picks in order to fill the rest of those spots. And so therefore, you know, whether it's 8 or 9, you have a couple of extra picks and you're in a position where you can, you know, move up or move down in order to move some of those picks to get either future picks next year or to get a really good player at a position of need this year. It's sort of just depends on sort of like I'm open to moving around to, you know, move up or move down, but it's not necessarily something that I automatically want to do. It just depends on what they do in free agency. So we got more questions coming up, including some free agent talk as well as some depth concerns from various listeners. But I do want to let you guys know about the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland. Find out wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your NBA team every day. So Luke Millar asks, if we cut Schaub, do we think about drafting someone like Brett Rypien in the 3rd or 4th round to be the backup, or would you be more willing to find a cheaper free agent alternative to Schaub? Well, technically, Schaub won't be cut because he's a free agent. But if you're basically saying that we let Schaub walk in free agency, I think there's a chance the Falcons would draft a quarterback. I think it's more likely that they would sign a cheap veteran, someone like a Trevor Siemian, rather than just going fully on the board with, you know, having a young guy. I think the presence of Kurt Benkert, if you assume, which I don't know if it's a safe assumption, but if you assume that the Falcons sort of saw Kurt Benkert as sort of their de facto 7th-round pick last year, which they didn't have a 7th-round pick, but if they had one, they might have used it on Kurt Benkert, then I think that probably means that they are unlikely to draft a quarterback this year, because they, in one form or fashion, from one perspective, did last year by signing Kurt Benkert. But I think there's a possibility that the Falcons could pull a trigger on a late round quarterback. I don't think it's going to come in the 3rd or 4th round, but I think it's possible, like in round 6, that they could pull the trigger on a guy. I don't think Brett Rypien's going to last that long, but he could. You never know. The draft is weird, and particularly smaller quarterbacks that don't have great arms tend to not be drafted as highly as other players. So it wouldn't totally shock me if Brett Rypien fell to like round 6 or 7. But I think more than likely he'll probably be like a 5th-round pick or something like that. So I don't necessarily expect him to be the specific pick for the Falcons, but, you know, we'll see. Andy at Falcons. Andy asks, if Rico is in doubt for week 1, do you think that KZ covers until he's back and then moves to the slot, or do they give him the preseason at slot corner and have somebody else fill in at free safety? Well, you know, first I'll say that I am somewhat optimistic that Ricardo Allen will be ready to play week 1 in the regular season. I think my main concern with Ricardo Allen's recovery is how effective he's going to be in training camp. And does that mean that someone's going to need to take some of those reps in training camp because he's limited in practice for 2 or 3 weeks and you need somebody to play, you know, one of those spots in camp. You know, with Poole likely being gone, you know, I'm going to assume that Casey's going to take all of the first team reps in the nickel. There is a reality where Casey also takes all the first team reps at free safety, assuming Allen is not back for the preseason and training camp. But the question is going to be who's going to be taking those reps in the nickel at safety, at free safety, if once Casey drops down and covers the slot. And I don't necessarily think that guy is currently on the roster. I don't think that's really what Sherrod Neesman does well. I thought Brian Poole could potentially play that role as well and give him some added versatility, given that I do think he's arguably, and this is an argument I've made many times over the years, that he projects better as a safety than he does as a cornerback. But that doesn't seem to be in the Falcons' plans or thought process. So I think there is a decent chance that the Falcons will find somebody else to sort of fill in as a body at that free safety position. I don't necessarily feel like it's going to be a priority during the offseason. I think that's more of a situation where the Falcons sort of wait and see as we get further along in the spring / summer and see sort of what Allen's window is for return. If him missing significant time in training camp is something that could or might happen, then I think you could see the Falcons doing what they did last year, which is like in May or June, looking out there and saying like, okay, where's a veteran body that can sort of come in like we did with Ron Parker and sort of be that guy until Allen is ready to go. And maybe that guy, if he plays well enough, will, you know, land a roster spot and, you know, push for a job. You know, maybe the Falcons sort of like think Jordan Richards could be that guy. I don't think that's a great fit for Jordan Richards, but at the same time, I think of the potential backups between Jordan Richards, Sherrod Neesman, and Ryan Neal, probably Jordan Richards is better suited for that role than some of those other guys are. So that is an option as well to bring him back and ask him to play those role, that spot. So we'll have to see. But again, I don't necessarily feel like this is something that needs to be a huge priority for the Falcons. They just kind of need a body. And right now they don't have one. So it's a question mark, but not necessarily one that's a huge one. All right. Our next question comes from JoeBear74. Could you elaborate about our defensive scheme? Which types of players that are needed for the scheme? How about why our defense still has a ton of issues, but teams like Seattle and Jacksonville are still known for their D? Could we realistically see a transition to a man or blitzing scheme? I think in a nutshell to explain the defensive scheme, it's basically a mix of cover three zone and cover one man. You know, I don't necessarily chart this stuff consistently. I have charted it in the past, but not consistently. So I'm basing this off of a limited sample size and making very rough estimates. I should stress that. But you know, the Falcons play base defense roughly about 35% of the time. And for the most part, I would guesstimate that they probably play cover three zone when they're in base defense about 90% of the time. And they play nickel defense about 65% of the time. And I would guesstimate that they probably split, you know, cover three zone versus cover one man about, you know, 40, 50, 60% of the time, somewhere in that range. So it's about an even split. And so it probably works out that the Falcons play man coverage about 25 to 35% of the time on defense. And oftentimes I think that's, you know, when they play cover one man in their nickel, and then third downs is dependent on down and distance. So if it's third and four, you know, they're going to play man. If it's third and nine, they're going to play zone. If it's, you know, second and seven, they're probably going to play zone or whatnot. And so that's sort of where it sort of splits. As far as other aspects of the scheme go, they're a 4-3 under front more often than not. And that sort of specifies where the defensive linemen and linebackers and what their gap assignments are and where they line up on the field. That's basically the scheme in a nutshell. It's nothing really too complicated. If you're still confused by some of the things that I said and don't really know what those terms I use mean, you can just basically Google them. Go Google cover three, Google 4-3 under front. And there was a ton of articles between like 2013 and 2015 that were written about the sort of the Seahawks defensive scheme that you can go and read that will basically break down those things in more simplified terms that don't sound as convoluted. So if you're curious about how what the Falcon scheme is, I think probably the simplest explanation for why the Falcons still have issues on defense is that they need more talent. You know, that's a very general statement, but I think this is a team that sort of has been built with speed in mind and built basically to play with a lead and is more of a pass oriented defense than a run oriented defense. And so, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think specifically in today's NFL, that's kind of how you have to be to win at the highest levels, in my opinion, as well as the fact that given the Falcons' offense is so prolific as it has been, that's kind of geared towards suited to the Falcons, but that can get them into problems from time to time. The other issue that the Falcons have is, you know, in contrast to the, say, the Mike Smith era, where a lot of the players that they targeted on defense were guys that were great from the neck up versus guys that were good from the neck down. You know, they were smart, high character guys, but weren't great athletes. The Dan Quinn defense is sort of, you can argue, has swung too far in the other direction, which is let's get great athletes, but let's not get guys that are, I won't say low character guys, that's not true, but guys that just aren't necessarily the most savvy or instinctual football players there are. And I think that leads to sort of a overall lack of discipline on the Falcons defense. And I don't mean that in the sense of like they get too many penalties. I just think that like they just blow too many assignments and make too many mental errors that lead to, you know, too many breakdowns. And you know, that leads to the results that we've seen over the last couple of years, where you have basically what has been an average at best defense for the most part in the Dan Quinn era. I think Seattle, particularly, and Jacksonville to a lesser extent, have been successfully able to find a balance in between those things, between, you know, having a roster that is good from the neck down versus good from the neck up, which I don't think the Falcons have really quite found yet. As for your last question in terms of seeing a transition to more man and blitzing, I don't think we'll see a major shift, but you certainly you can make a case that we will see more man coverage this year. We will see more blitzing this year, but not in any way where it's going to be a significant shift from what we've done over the last 4 years. Like, this is not going to suddenly morph into a defense that's predicated on its ability to play a lot of man coverage or blitzing a whole lot like you see, particularly with some of the 3-4 defenses that you see around the league, like those that are employed by Wade Phillips or Todd Bowles or historically by Rex Ryan and those types of guys. So I don't think you'll see that, but I do think you can see a touch more increase as far as man coverage and blitzing more, because those two things sort of go hand in hand, because you blitz more often when you're playing man coverage. There are zone blitzes and whatnot, but if you want to blitz, you typically play a lot more man coverage, and the Falcons can play more man coverage, one would hope, because they're getting guys like Jones and Allen and Neal back this season as opposed to last year when they were struggling to replace those guys, and thus I think played a little bit more conservatively, which I think, you know, a lot of people complained about, but I don't think was a poor choice, again, given the offense and basically not being overly aggressive and falling into some holes early in games that would put the offense at a disadvantage. So I got why they sort of went conservative this past season. That being said, we still got more questions to answer on today's episode coming up. But before we get there, I do want to let you guys know about the 2 episodes devoted to the NFL draft on the Locked On Podcast Network. They are the Locked On NFL Draft podcast hosted by John Ledger and Trevor Sikkema, as well as the Draft Dudes podcast hosted by Kyle Krabs and Joe Marino. You can find them both wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, as well as at thedraftnetwork.com. Your team every day. Tracy Edwards at Vic Tracy Ed asks, give me your most out of left field prediction for the first round. Thomas Dimitrov always stuns us, but what prediction do you have that we should have all seen coming? Podcast question. You know, just spitballing here. Garrett Bradbury, the center from North Carolina State. Clem DB at Clem Frico, he asks, question from Paris. For the Q&A, weeks ago you suggested that it would be good for Vic Beasley to work this summer on his technique with a pass rush guru. Don't we have coaches for that? What are they doing all summer / year long with Vic? I think part of the problem, Clem, is, and shout out to my international listeners from Paris and other countries, but I think part of the issue is the current collective bargaining agreement puts real limitations on off-season work and practices, and players don't get a lot of time to spend with coaches during the off-season. You know, this is reason number 482 why I think the NFL needs a developmental league like the AAF, because you need reps, and that's really the only way that guys get reps for basically half the season. And particularly for some of these positions, like a pass rusher, like Vic Beasley plays, that are more technique-driven than necessarily positions that you can just simply go out there and just be a great athlete and find success in. Positions like running back and, to a lesser extent, like linebacker and whatnot, are positions like that. And cornerback, again, but there are some technical aspects of playing cornerback. So I think basically the way that the rules are set up now, that between the end of the season and the middle of April, coaches aren't really allowed to contact players and talk to players and interact with players. And then you sort of get those first couple of weeks of OTAs, which is basically just lifting weights for 2 weeks. And then, you know, the teams draft, and then they come back with their rookie mini camps. But the veterans come back for some May mini camps and some June mini camps. But I think those only really work out to about 2 weeks worth of practices, which is where they're actually getting legitimate on-field work. And then they get basically the entire month of July off before training camp comes. So you get like over a 6 or 7 month period between January and July. Your veteran player might only really get like 10 or 15 days of actual on-field work with their respective coach. And so the rest of that time is really just spent staying in shape and doing their own sort of work. And then even in training camp, you're really, you know, technically training camp only really lasts like 3 weeks. And then things start to shift to, it's more about sort of the game prep that teams do during the regular season than necessarily working on your skills. So players don't really get as much time as I think people think they do. And this is one of the reasons why you have people like Chuck Smith and you have these MMA training academies, and why Matt Ryan takes all the receivers and tight ends down to Florida for a weekend each year to get the work in. Because the way that the league is set up now, which is, you know, with the idea of player safety involved to put less wear and tear on players' bodies and extend players' careers, doesn't really help foster development in the league. And I can certainly, again, go deeper on this as far as, you know, why that makes developmental leagues like the AAF, et cetera, more valuable and more necessary to get the best product on the field for the NFL. But to answer your specific question about Beasley, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why you can't necessarily expect the team's coaches to basically fix him. And you also have to factor in that not all coaches are created equal. You have a player like Danielle Hunter from Minnesota, who was the super raw piece of clay when he got to Minnesota, you know, what, 4-ish years ago. And they've sort of molded him into one of the NFL's premier pass rushers. But Minnesota has historically done a lot to sort of develop, you know, mid-round pass rushers like Brian Robeson and Everson Griffin, along with Hunter. And so one can argue that Minnesota does a really good job taking some of these, you know, raw pieces of clay and molding them. And that's historically what the Falcons haven't really had a lot of success doing, outside of guys like Grady Jarrett. And I'm sure there are other players historically but it hasn't been a sort of consistent thing. You didn't see that really with Massacoy. You didn't really see that with Sidbury, et cetera. You know, like, you can sit there and fault the Falcons coaches for not being good enough to sort of coach these guys up, but coaching a guy specifically like Vic Beasley up, but, you know, you can't necessarily hold it against everybody. Like, basically, you can make the argument that the Vikings have the Bill Belichick of defensive line coaches, and the Falcons may have, like, I don't know, the Bill O'Brien. You know, Bill O'Brien's perfectly fine, but, like, you know, there's some limitations there. Do you fire Bill O'Brien because he's not Bill Belichick? I don't think so. You know, you can find other reasons to fire Bill O'Brien, to continue this analogy, but, like, I don't think you just say, well, he's not Bill Belichick. And it's like, of course he's not Bill Belichick, you know? So, yeah, you know, I wish the coaches would do more, but so far they really haven't. And so I think we need to see Beasley do more outside of Atlanta to get better, if we're going to really expect significant results. So last question today comes from Ryan Helton at That Crazy YM. He asked, fried or baked wings? And any tips for a first time for a first timer wanting to make my own wings? I typically deep fry my wings. I think it's easier to do. Before I had a deep fryer, I used to bake my wings. But I think, you know, if you are going to be a wing connoisseur like myself, I think investing in a half decent deep fryer is worthwhile. But, you know, I'm not necessarily as health conscious. I probably should be. So the idea of sort of deep frying is not necessarily an issue for me, particularly like when I read things like it's not the nature of deep frying. It's the oil you use. And I probably don't use the healthiest oils I can use, but they're the sort of the cheapest oils that you can buy in bulk. You know, I typically use peanut oil or vegetable oil, or canola oil. I think peanut oil is the best, but there's obvious reasons why, you know, many people out there would avoid peanut oil due to allergies and whatnot. So I wound up just settling for vegetable oil or canola oil for the most part to deep fry my wings. But there are ways of baking your wings where you can get them pretty darn close to deep fried wings. The main issue I would say for that, if you're going to cook your wings in the oven, it's probably healthier for you, but it also produces a lot of smoke if you're going to try to get that crispy skin that you typically get from deep fried wings. And so one tip that you can use to avoid that is to sort of render the fat out of your chicken wings before you put them in the oven, because and the way that you can do that is basically steaming them for like 20 minutes. And that will render some of the fat. It won't get all of it out. You don't want to basically pre-cook your wings, but you want to render some of the fat out, and then that will reduce the amount of smoke that your oven will produce. So that's a tip. The other tip is about wingtips, and there's two things I would say about that. If you're the type of person uses chicken stock and chicken broth and other things that you cook, I wouldn't discard those wingtips if you buy the whole wings and cut them up yourself. That's a little cheaper than necessarily buying them already pre-cut in the drums and flats that you can get most often. Again, you may have a grocery store or butcher or somebody that will hook you up there, and it won't be any different than buying the wings whole. But just get a decent pair of meat scissors for like $8 or whatever, or less, and just buy them whole, and you'll reap the savings long term. But don't throw away those wingtips, because you can make a pretty okay, I'm not going to say a great chicken stock. I mean, maybe if you're a world star, a five-star chef, you could maybe whip up a great stock with wingtips. But you can make a decent chicken stock with those wingtips and use them for other recipes. The other thing about wingtips is if you're making your own sauce for wings, I would say save those wingtips and actually cook them with the flats and the drums when you're frying them or baking them or whatever you're doing. And then don't throw them away, but use them to sort of test your sauce, because once you put your wings in the sauce, you won't be able to really make any significant adjustments to your sauce. So if you want to be like, I don't know, is this lemon pepper that I made, is it too tart? And do I need to balance out the flavor, or did I put too much garlic in this sauce, or is it too spicy or whatever? Use the wingtips before you put the sauce on your regular wings to sort of taste the sauce, because it's going to basically taste exactly the same on those wingtips as it's going to taste on the regular wings. So that's really your last opportunity, I think, to really adjust the sauce if you're going to make homemade sauce for your wings and whatnot. So there's your chicken wing breakdown. Those are my tips that I would give you. So there you have it, guys. I appreciate everybody for sending in the questions. Again, check out the leftover mailbag that you will be able to find on FalcFans.com this weekend. You can leave a comment at FalcFans.com, where the podcast is posted daily for future Q&As. You can also send in your Q&A questions to the email address at LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. You can also send them to social media accounts on Twitter, Locked On Falcons, on Facebook, Locked On Falcons as well. So there you have it, guys. Appreciate you guys listening. And we'll be back Monday with something. I don't know exactly what we'll do, but we'll do something. So send in your questions, and maybe it'll be another Q&A. Maybe we'll get to more questions. So if you have, if you have additional questions, I eat too many chicken wings. Anyway, all right, until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.